Like I was saying, currency exchange rates play a major role in the market price at which it's profitable to produce Alaskan coal for the global market. And some of the other problems are cultural practices of some of our overseas countries, the existence or the lack of existence of transportation infrastructure here in Alaska. But in the final analysis, probably the most important factor in bringing our coal to market is the existence of a good relationship between the industry and the state. From this relationship, industry needs a fair, stable, regulatory playing field in order to market its products to its investors and customers. And the state needs to know that its resource is being developed responsibly so that the land from which the coal is extracted is going to be a viable resource for Alaskans for generations to come. Today, we've got both sides here, some of the one commissioner and another office and of the government, and then we've got the industry here, and we're going to try to develop a better understanding of these issues that surround Alaska's coal industry. And with that, I think first I'd like to introduce Commissioner John Shively and let him go first. That way he can stay for the whole meeting if he has time. If he has to go, he'll be free to leave. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Shively. I'm Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, and just starting with the person that knows least about this issue, my main experience with coal was when I used to shuttle it into the furnace in our house when I was a boy, something I stopped doing when my dad decided to install an oil furnace, which I was eternally grateful for. You've stated some of the opportunities we have for coal. It's always been one of Alaska's sort of undeveloped resources, largely constrained by price and location, which is a problem for us. And these days probably also constrained somewhat by government regulation, as is most resource development. Of course, our main mine is the Usabelli mine, and that the state does take in about $1.4 million a year in royalties from that operation. Our next project that we see on the horizon is what we call the Jarvis Creek lease sale, which is up in the Tok Delta area. This is something that we're through the public comment period on the best interest finding. We're in the process of finalizing the best interest finding and hope to go to a lease sale sometime this spring. The main purpose of this coal lease will be to supply a project in Tok, which is partially funded by the Department of Energy, where we replace a diesel plant with a plant that would burn a combination coal, wood, and waste. And it is a project that obviously has some implications for other parts of the state if it works. So we're sort of interested in that. So far in my brief 3 weeks of being commissioner, I've concentrated a little more on oil and gas initiatives that I have on coal. And fortunately for you, you have a bunch of people here who know a lot more about it than I do. And so I think I'll let them proceed. But I'd be pleased to answer any questions if you have them.
Very good. You gentlemen have any questions, Commissioner? I might have one. You mentioned, as I did, that one of the biggest problems is regulations. Do you, and I know you've only been here 3 weeks, but do you know if the administration has any plans or any clues that they give these folks about the future and any changes you might make during the next 4 years?
Well, I think if there's anything we would like to do, and this has been a challenge for I think administrations that came along before ours, is to get some common sense out of what government does and to confine the time frame so that they're more reasonable. I don't think anybody argues with the need to have responsible development that protects the environment. I mean, I've never heard industry argue that. The problem is that it takes so long for government to determine what responsible development is that very few people can afford to proceed to look at major developments. And so I think the challenge really for the administration is to make some sense out of that. And it's something I'm committed to, and when I discussed taking this job with the governor, it's something I wanted to make sure he was interested in, and I believe he is, as is Commissioner Burden, I know, who is responsible for a good many of those regulations.
I'm sure these folks are all going to be glad to hear that.
Well, we have to produce, which is sometimes producing in this arena is difficult, but it is a goal.
Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Shively, can you, along that line regarding regulations, the regulatory environment here, could you comment on the administration's action in reopening the Clean Water Act and any ideas in that regard of why that was reopened or anything that could be done to help the people in this room out?
Really, Commissioner Burden is who you want to talk to about that, and he did talk to the group yesterday about the reasons for doing that, and I just have to say I was not involved in that decision, and he has some reasons that he thinks they needed to be reopened, so I think he's better able to answer them.
And another more upbeat question. Are you aware of anything that's planned or even aware at all of the activities that relate to the potential coal methane activity in the Mathew Valley and other areas there?
Yeah, in fact, I'm glad you mentioned that. That was raised yesterday. Coal bed methane is something that's intrigued me when I was in a previous life at NANA because we had coal resources up in that area. We are watching with interest what's going on in the Mat Valley with that. We're also interested in, there's a sort of a new drilling technology, it's not new technology, but I think new to maybe being used this way, and that's the coil tubing technology that would make drilling for coal bed methane much cheaper. And I think that provides us a real opportunity in the rural areas to look at alternative energy. As you know, we have a real problem out there with fuel tanks and getting them into compliance with state and federal laws, and an alternative fuel source might help solve that problem.
Just to follow up on that, in some of the hearings that I've been involved with lately, I share one thing with you. I'm a newcomer down here. It seems interesting, particularly relates to the rural power cost equalization situation, where there's an endowment now that's been established, and assumingly the sinking fund aspect of that endowment appears to be a 4 to 5, 6 year life. At that time, there's going to be some other very difficult decisions made by the state of Alaska on a policy basis to what to do about that. And it seems to me that we have a very short opening or a very short time frame in a window here to look at alternate technologies and other methods of providing electrical power in the rural areas of the state. And some of these areas that relate to coal methane, things of this nature, I think could be a real shot in the arm for economic development in the state, as well as providing that needed energy we have in the rural areas. Do you have any ideas, or are you interested in pursuing any kind of pilot projects along this line?
Yeah, well, I've asked our people to look at that. We have, right now, there's a dispute, as often happens in government, as to sort of who's sort of supposed to oversee some of this. The Alaska Oil and Gas Commission has sort of said they have some jurisdiction, and their jurisdiction makes drilling for this kind of gas relatively expensive, at least as I understand it, because some of their bonding requirements. That's an issue we need to get resolved. But yeah, I'm very interested in looking at both technologies, both what could happen if this Toke plant is built, how that might be used in rural areas, and also coal bed methane, where we could use that. Those are two. And there may be some other shallow gas opportunities also. Vero, of course, has benefited greatly from the availability of natural gas over the years, and we'd like to expand the use of that fuel.
Anything else?
Yes, sir.
Representative Goring.
I was going to ask almost the identical questions or make the identical comments in regard to coal bed methane. I live in the Matanuska Valley, and I guess it's real promising, the potential out there. I think there's even a shallow well drilled out there, and so it looks real promising, and there's supposedly a big coal belt from Houston all the way up to Sutton area there. So I'd sure like to explore what possibilities exist there as far as opening up potential drilling activity and so forth. But I just wonder if perhaps a way to help spur such development, at least on a small scale, would be to lower the bonding requirements. What would your thoughts be on that?
Well, I think that under the Alaska Oil and Gas Commission, the bonding requirement of $1 million is wrong. I mean, there's not that kind of risk. That's the kind of bonding requirement you need really for oil drilling. Gas is not you know, a big problem. I mean, if it starts to leak, you put a match to it. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, I mean, that's... I guess that was probably a facetious comment, but which will get me in trouble with Commissioner Burden, but anyway. But, yeah, I think the $1 million is way too high. That's my personal opinion.
Looking into the possibility of a bill that would amend last year's legislation, I guess they had dropped $5 million to $1 million to drop it even further for a coal bed methane.
That's a, I think that may be a different bonding requirement, but I'm not really. I mean, we have some things that come out of DEC and some that come out of the Oil and Gas Commission.
Which organization should I work with?
I'll figure that out for you, and I'll get back to you.
Any further questions for Commissioner Shively? Nothing. Well, in that case, Commissioner, I think it's the first time I've seen you since you've been appointed. I'd like to congratulate you. I'm looking forward to working with you for the next 4 years. I think you'll do a good job.
Thank you, Jerry. I appreciate that. I'm looking forward to it, too. I think, you know, we're faced with some great opportunities right now. I think we can work together to make some of those things come into being. We're all going to be pretty happy in 4 years.
And let the record reflect that Representative Ed Willis showed up here at 9:25, just a little late from a very important meeting. And
Mr. Chairman,
yes,
you have to excuse me because I have another very important meeting to go to. I wish I could stay here because this is going to be very interesting.
It's called a governmental shuffle here.
I'll read the minutes. I thought it was
okay. See, if you'd have slipped out, we wouldn't even know, mention you were gone. But next, we'd like to call one more person from the government, and then we'll get into the real meat of the discussion. Ms. Gabrielle LaRoche from Commerce and Economic Development.
Thank you. My name is Gabrielle LaRoche. I am Section Chief for Resource Development within the Division of Economic Development. Deputy Commissioner Jeff Bush is in the audience here today. Representative Sanders, members of the House Special Committee on Economic Development, I wish to extend the appreciation for the opportunity to participate in this forum on behalf of the Department of Commerce and Economic Development. Today I'd like to present a very brief overview of industry and the department's involvement, and of course be available for any questions that you may have. Coal currently represents approximately 8.5% of the production value of Alaska's mining industry. However, Alaska coal reserves are one of its greatest assets. The potential for additional development of coal resources is quite significant. Alaska's total estimated coal reserves are estimated to range between 5 and 5 trillion tons. This resource represents an energy equivalent in BTUs of more than 1,000 Prudhoe Bays. It is estimated that as much as 55% of Alaska's coal resource is high-rank bituminous coal. Alaska's bituminous coal is sought after because of its low sulfur and nitrogen contents, which results in a cleaner burning product. Because of these and other favorable attributes, Alaska's coals are among the most environmentally safe in the world. This advantage, notwithstanding, high production and transportation costs combined with price competition from countries like Australia and Indonesia are inhibiting further commercial development of Alaska's coal resources at this time. The Yusubeli, as was mentioned before, at Healy is the only large-scale coal mine currently operational in Alaska, producing 1.51 million tons of coal in 1994. About half of the Yusubeli production is exported to South Korea. This is a contract with Sunil, now Hyundai Marine, and KEPCO. This contract was recently extended through 1995. Another major Alaska coal investor, Idemitsu, Alaska, has temporarily canceled its plans to mine the premier coal seam in the Wishbone Hill area. This decision was due predominantly to continued low prices in the Pacific Rim steam coal market. It is estimated that the Wishbone Hill contains reserves of over 15 million tons of high-rank coal. The largest steam coal markets reasonably available for Alaska are the Pacific Rim countries of China, India, Japan, and Korea. Current coal consumption for all of Asia is approximately 1.6 billion tons per year. Forecasts indicate that Asia consumption should reach over 2.1 billion tons annually by the year 2000 and exceed 2.75 tons annually by 2010. The projected increases in Asian coal demand offer opportunities for Alaska to expand coal exports into these developing and growing markets. Much of the coal currently imported into Asia comes from Australia and Indonesia. Both of these suppliers are able to greatly affect the world steam coal price because of their large production, relatively low unit costs, and strength of current market share. Other major producers, although volatile, are China and the former Soviet Union. The Pacific Rim steam coal market is expected to rebound, and indeed recent conclusion of the new Korean contract with Yusubeli reflects such improvements. Nevertheless, Alaska market penetration into Pacific Rim coal markets remains quite small. However, there is potential for greater Alaska market penetration. As markets rebound, projects such as the Wishbone Hill and Western Arctic coal may see a window of opportunity to develop and gain significant market share. Of equal importance to the people of Western and Arctic Alaska, the successful development of Western Arctic coal reserves could provide very competitive alternative for village and individual power consumption to diesel fuel, which is currently imported to the region, as you know, at a very high price. The utilization of Alaska coal also offers the very significant benefit of jobs for Alaska in mining and coal beneficiation. The Department of Commerce and Economic Development has been involved in the Alaska coal industry and continues to actively work with a variety of coal interests. The department's mineral specialists directly interact with the coal industry through the Alaska Minerals Commission, and I brought several copies of the report, but I believe you all probably have one. They were distributed, I believe, to everyone. The Minerals Commission is staffed by our minerals specialists, and in this report, in the 1995 report, there is a finding regarding the exclusion of mining operations from the state's reclamation bonding pool, and that this is an issue for the coal industry. And one of the recommendations contained in the report is that inclusion of all mining companies in reclamation bonding pool, and that's Alaska Statute 27. There's a citation on that. The Department mineral specialists provide active assistance in many coal and coal-related developments in the state. Specific examples include Healy Clean Coal Project, the Northwest Arctic Coal at Deadfall Syncline, Wishbone Hill and Beluga projects, and the Low-Rank Coal Water Fuel Demonstration Project. ADA assisted in the development of the Seward Coal Export Terminal and is currently one of the major investors and project manager for the Healy Clean Coal Project. Healy Clean Coal represents a major expansion in the electric power generation capabilities at Healy. The department supports the Arctic Regional Corporation in its ongoing efforts to demonstrate the viability of and implement mining and export of Northwest Arctic coal deposits. Mining of Deadfall Syncline coal deposits not only will produce long-term jobs, but may also develop a cost-effective energy source for the north and western part of Alaska, as I stated previously. The department continues to work, and particularly OIT and ADA, with Yusubeli and the Alaska Railroad and KEPCO to assure the long-term viability of Yusubeli export contract. And that concludes my testimony, and I'm certainly available for questions. And I do have some written copies if there's anything that would be of interest that you might want to have on hand.
I would like to have a written copy of that, please. There's a lot of good information in there, and I'm sure I didn't memorize it all while I was listening. Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. LaRoche?
I have one minute. You had mentioned that the Wishbone Hill project was temporarily on hold, basically. It's my understanding that it was permanently out of the picture at this point. Is there still hope that it might come back online?
I guess we always have hope. We don't like to assume that, and there are significant reserves there. It's in a good location. There's got to be a point at which the right things come together to make it work.
Not with the firm that was going to originally do it, though, most likely. Is that
most right? Likely.
Okay. And in regard to the Healy Clean Coal project that you made reference to, is that currently under construction right now in that facility?
I'm not exactly sure what the status of that is right now, but I could certainly check on that for you.
I'm a little interested in the funding aspect of that as well, because I heard that there was a bit of a shortfall and that they were seeking other funds to make up the difference through ADA or somebody. So
I'll make a note to get back to your office on that.
Helpful information. Thank you.
Okay, are there any other questions? Well, Ms. Feroz, thank you very much. We appreciate it. I hope you'll stay in case there's questions from some of the public sector here when they get up to talk.
Certainly. Thank you.
We're fixing to get into the good part of this. We're going to talk to some real live private sector people that know about coal. We're going to start off with Mr. Bob Stiles, who's the president of the Alaska Coal Association, and I suppose he'll give an overview, and then we'll get into the different coal areas.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Bob Stiles. I'm president of the Alaska Coal Association, which is an honorary, although that's arguable, position. I'm also president of DeArvin Corporation. We're involved in the coal developments in the Beluga field. And we have a number of folks, as you said, in the private sector that'll speak and cover some details, and I'll just run over those quickly. Mr. Charlie Green, who will speak right after me, will cover the Healy Clean Coal Project. Warwick Wilson will speak to the low-rank coal water fuel developments. Kate Lamal with Golden Valley Electric will speak to some of the user group issues involved in the industry. Teresa M. on Western Arctic Coal. John Sims in terms of the some constraints with regard to domestic U.S. use of Alaskan coal. And Charlie Bodie will kind of bat cleanup in terms of the Alaska coal policy that was passed by the legislature a couple of years ago. First, I'd like to just a quick overview in terms of the resource. As you can see in the map up there, the coal in the state is concentrated in a couple of large bands. That north of the Arctic slope, which is predominantly bituminous coal. The green coal, the green stuff is bituminous or bituminous reserves. There are some interior Yukon province coal deposits, which certainly offer great potential for local use as a replacement for oil. And then we have the Susitna Basin, which includes I skipped our only producing coal mine, and that's the Nana Basin, Yusubeli. And then the area around the Cook Inlet that includes both subbituminous and bituminous reserves includes the Wishbone Hill area and then the Beluga reserves. And there are some small deposits somewhat further to the east. The Jarvis Creek area, in fact, is one that in the northeastern portion or north of the Cook Inlet region. Quickly, in terms of where those reserves might move, clearly the reserves around the Cook Inlet are primary market's going to be export, and that's export to we would expect predominantly Japan, Korea, Taiwan, conceivably the coast of China, outside possibility coast of Russia, potentially to Mexico, the western portion of the Pacific Northwest of the U.S., and possibly Hawaii. The interior reserves are competitive in international markets, certainly have the difficulty associated with some interior, with some fairly long transportation distance to the coast. Those reserves that are sort of in pockets in the interior are certainly most likely to be used or developed for local use. And the Western Arctic coal, of course, due to its high value, has a high heating value, has some potentials both in the international market in the long term and in the local markets in the near term. With regard to what's happening in what really controls our business in international markets, we have faced about a five-year slide in international prices. We believe strongly that this year the worm has turned. All the indications are that the current negotiations on what's called a benchmark price, that we'll see an uptick of anywhere from $2 to $6 per ton on the benchmark coal, which is a bituminous coal. Now, that a $6 uptick on bituminous coal translates to probably a $4 uptick on subbituminous coal. There are, well, you're always enthusiastic about seeing an uptick in price. We hope that it's not too big. And The reason for that is that if it's too large, there will be other production developed in response to that uptick in price, which makes the competitive playing field even more difficult than it is now. The question as to why Alaskan coal resources are underdeveloped, I can tell you for at least the last several years, and that meaning 5 or 6 years, the predominant reason has been not price, but the Mental Health Lands Trust litigation. That had an incredible chilling effect in the marketplace. And if you can't market, and you have no credibility in the market if you try, you can't sell, and if you can't sell, you don't develop new mines. That sword of Damocles is still out there. It, as you know, it's in the court system. The legislature did an excellent job in the special session last year in bringing that to closure and doing everything that they can possibly do to get that issue resolved. We now rest at the mercy of the courts, who sometimes seem to move with glacial speed. If they don't move quick enough, there's always a good chance that sub-bituminous coal will be bituminous coal by the time that issue's cleared up. The important thing about the contradictory factor that we've seen in the marketplace during the time of this price slide is we've seen a continued increase in demand. So we don't operate like the classic economic model. But the it's clear that this year, quick example of what that slide in price means. In international contracts are all U.S. dollar denominated. So the exchange rates begin to have an effect when you have an Australian producer selling to Japan on a U.S. dollar denominated contract. Their dollar has been declining relative to the U.S. dollar, so they could take big price hits and they really didn't feel it at home. That situation has changed. The Australian dollar strengthened relative to the U.S. dollar, and last year's hit that they took cut to the bone, and that is one of the predominant reasons for the difficulty of the negotiations that are going on right now. The Australians are holding firm. The net effect of all of that is, if you look at what the Japanese utilities are paying for their coal, for example, on a BTU basis, they're paying half today in yen terms that they were paying 10 years ago because of the strengthening of the yen relative to the U.S. dollar. So there should be a lot of room for increases in price over the long term. We would not expect that the price increase that we do expect next year would be anything like the one that we see this year. But the important issue is it's a change in the slope of the curve from trending down. We believe it's going to start trending up. I'll just briefly cover two or three projects that are not represented here today, i.e. Wishbone. While certainly the decline in the price of coal had a chilling effect on that project, the real killer was the Mental Health Trust litigation. In the Beluga field, there are two properties, the Diamond Chewitna property, which I'm responsible for, and the Beluga Coal Company property that is owned by Placer Dome U.S. and Siri. There are at least 2 billion tons of proven reserves, I'm sorry, of proven and probable reserves in that field. There are in excess of 500 million tons of mineable reserves, which are real numbers. That field could be produced, given the market, at the rate of 10, 15 million tons per year. It is a sub-bituminous coal. It probably offers the largest near-term, and near-term meaning within the next 10 years, potential for development. There are certainly other smaller developments, potential developments around the state. Now, to give you some sort of feel for what that means in the overall marketplace, Within the natural market for that coal, with Japan, Korea, Taiwan, and possibly Mexico, that would represent a capture of maybe 10% of the growth in the market. Only 2 or 3% of the market share. Those are reasonable goals. Capturing a 20% market share is not a reasonable goal. So if you look at the growth, what's available out there for production not online now, is an incremental share of the growth in the market. The base market is satisfied. We think that that coal in an Alaskan context holds great potential as far as being a dominant player in the world markets. Certainly none of us would be around here by the time that ever happened. That's probably not in the cards. But 10 or 15 million tons a year is a lot of production. It's small compared to what you see come out of Wyoming at 200 million tons a year. But again, in an Alaskan context, it's significant. And with that, I'll close my extended remarks and be happy to answer any questions, and we'll go on from there.
Very good. Thank you, sir. Do we have any questions for Mr. Stiles?
Mr. Chairman,
sure.
Bob,
Representative Willis.
Thank you. What is the status of anything that's being done with pulverizing? I think the term would be slurry in transportation, you know, where they pulverize, mix with water, and
In the absence of some upgrading of the coal, i.e., the coal water fuel, low rank coal water fuel project or technology, that doesn't offer just slurrying coal doesn't offer a lot of potential for Alaska, and it's to a large extent market constrained. Our customers buy their coal; they multi-source their fuel supply at the plant level. Which means that any individual plant in Asia is receiving coal from multiple suppliers, multiple not only in terms of countries, but producers within the country. Their systems are designed to handle a dry bulk product. So if you, while it might be very cheap and cost effective to transport a slurried coal, when the ship gets to the other end, there isn't anybody can unload it. And they can't fire in their boilers. You have to go through some, you have to apply technology to it, something on the order of the low rank coal water fuel.
Any further questions?
I suppose I can ask one.
What?
I'm trying to formulate my thoughts here as far as what I'd like to ask here. I'm just wondering about the more promising fields throughout the state. I'm just considering their locations, the deposits and everything, and the proximity of those deposits to potential export sites, and where there could be a port facility or whatever. Are we in a situation where much of what is out there in terms of the reserves is not necessarily economically feasible to go after, just given its remoteness and that kind of thing? Or are there quite a few fields out there that are that could be economical at this point to produce? Or
you got to be close to the salt chuck to play in the international market. If you either have to be close to existing transportation, i.e. rail belt, or you've got to be close to the coast. It's the only two ways that you have any hope of getting breaking into the international markets. If you begin to look at some of the fields in the Yukon area, those are not likely to ever see export. One of the problems with coal is it's abundant and ubiquitous. The Australians have got a hell of a lot of it. The South Africans have a lot of it. The Indonesians have a lot of it. China is the world's largest producer of coal. They burn a lot, but they need a lot. The Russians their former Soviet Union has tremendous coal reserves, not too dissimilar from what we have here. Colombia and Venezuela have extensive coal reserves. So there's a lot of it out there, and a lot of it potentially developable. But when you begin to look at places like South Africa, the reserves that are developed are relatively close to the coast. Now, they have a tremendous infrastructure system to support the transportation and port facilities for getting that coal into the markets. So the major deterrent to interior development of some of those fields, first of all, they aren't explored. So the numbers that we hear quoted about what we confuse resources with reserves. Reserves have a very definite meaning. That means that you've measured them in some way. What we have in terms of proven and probable reserves in this state is something on the order of 2 or 3 billion tons. The 5.5 trillion tons that you often hear quoted is about as relevant to the economic development potential as the fact that we have more coastline than the rest of the United States, but our beachfront development is, we're not a big player in that market. I think that once you get away from the coast, the predominant use of those coal reserves are going to be for domestic consumption and power generation, unless they're on a rail boat. Did that help?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Willis.
Well, how does Wyoming have a large export market to the Pacific Rim countries, for example?
No. The they are. Wyoming probably exports less coal. In fact, I'm sure that they export less coal to the Pacific Rim than Usabelli does to Korea. They are trying to get into that market. The predominant U.S. coals, steam coals that go to the Pacific Rim come out of Utah and will go through the Port of Long Beach. And that's going to be a fairly small number, I believe, something on the order of 4 or 5 million tons a year total when that's fully developed. The Wyoming coals, which are very similar to our subituminous coals, have a tremendous inland transport problem in that they're 1,000 or 1,500 miles from the coast. While the coal may be produced for and sold at the mine for on the order of $4 or $5 a ton, by the time it gets to the West Coast, that coal is $25 or $30 a ton. And all the difference is in transportation. That's the reason that you won't see a lot of development of interior coals that aren't already on the rail belt as far as export.
Thank you.
I have just one question. You being with the Beluga operation, if and when the market develops, do you have any idea yet where you'll bring that to Tidewater? Has it been narrowed down? Or?
There are three potential sites. One at Granite Point, one at North Foreland, which is the old KLM dock facility, and one at LAD. I would have to tell you today that the preferred choice is probably North Foreland, the existing Tyonic facility, or existing facility at Tyonic. There are impediments associated with the utilization of that existing facility, and they're predominantly related to bridges. Need a couple of bridges in there, one of them across the Chewitna River and one of them across a little place called Lone Creek. Those are the kinds of things, state participation in the development of that infrastructure, that are not terribly expensive but are absolutely crucial to being able to get coal to market.
Good. Looks like that's all the questions.
Thank you.
We'll move along here and like to talk to, or like to listen to Steve Denton with the Healy Clean Coal Power Project. Now we'll know.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not Steve Denton.
You're not Steve
Denton. No, I'm not. I'm a pinch hitter for a pinch hitter.
Okay.
My name is Charlie Green. And I'm assistant to the vice president for marketing for Usabelli Coal Mine. And obviously, I'm not an official spokesman for ADA, Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, which is a project owner, or Golden Valley Electric Association, which will operate the new power plant and purchase the power. But obviously, Yosubeli Coal Mine is a very interested observer. So as a very interested observer here, I'm going to give you what I know about the project. In essence, this was begun nearly 6 years ago. Yosubeli Coal Mine, ADA, and Golden Valley made application to the U.S. Department of Energy to propose this project, which in fact would access matching federal grants. Congress in the 80s, U.S. Congress had been very interested in making grant monies available to accelerate the development and commercialization of coal-burning technologies, clean coal-burning technologies. Obviously, the U.S. has enormous coal reserves. Something like 60% of all the electricity in the United States is generated by coal. So not only was there an interest in improving emissions from coal-fired power plants, but also to lead the world in the development of technology, and that would be good for U.S. technology and commerce to be able to export that technology. Since the project was awarded by DOE in 1989, it's been about 6 years, and it's been a long process. It's involved going through the environmental impact statement, having the Alaska Public Utilities Commission approve power sales agreement, having the issuance of an air quality permit from Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. There have been negotiations and appeals and legal actions taken by environmental groups. The project is a neighbor, very close neighbor to Denali National Park, so there was a very real concern there would be any air impacts there, and so there were lengthy negotiations with the Park Service. But all of that was resolved this past November. Everybody looked forward to the opening of the general contractor bids and getting on with the project. Unfortunately, when those bids were opened, the low bid was $25 million greater than the engineer's estimate. So to the great credit of ADA, and they went back to the drawing board one more time and managed to overcome the final hurdle. On February 1, the H.C. Price Company, which was the low bidder, was awarded the final notice to proceed with construction. To get there, in essence, to bridge that $25 million gap, there was a number of contributions to the project. Basically, Golden Valley Electric Association and Yosubeli Coal Mine, when you combine contributions, have taken up about $12 million of that $25 million gap. Golden Valley, in terms of some of its power sales agreement, in terms of the sale of power to the contractor, and some other items of which I am not an expert on. Yosubeli, we will be modifying our solid waste landfill permit to, in essence, take construction wastes from the project. That was a way in which we could reduce the contractor's costs. We're going to make some facilities available at no cost. We will be providing equipment to the project at significantly reduced rates. So those sorts of things have contributed to $12 million. ADA has also gotten some contributions from some of the other participants, including the manufacturers of the equipment. A final and very significant chunk of that gap is expected to come from the Department of Energy. Their contribution of this project is about $117 million, and the idea is if the Department of Energy can advance those funds to the project so that they can sit in essence an interest-bearing account. Rather than being dispersed over time to the project, if that interest and investment earnings can accrue to the project, that would add an additional $6 or $7 million. So that's the way in which the last obstacle, hopefully, has been overcome on this project. The schedule is I think H.C. Price plans to begin initial foundation work in either April or May. Construction will take place in 1995 through 1997. In 1998, the project will undergo a one-year demonstration period. Because this is We've got matching funds from the Department of Energy because this is a demonstration of a new technology. Part of the agreement is there is a one-year period where between the Department of Energy and they can look at very carefully at the performance of this plant, possibly burn other coals in it to see how they perform. And then in 1999, it would become into full commercial production, operated by Golden Valley Electric Association. The project has many benefits to it, and from a longtime Interior resident, not the least of which is Golden Valley has a needed new power facility. They are looking in the at the turn of the century here of having a lot of their generating capacity, including their oil-fired turbines at North Pole, as being at the end of their useful life. So they had to make a decision as to what their next generating facility was going to be, and this project fit in nicely. Probably of the new 50 megawatts of power that will come out of that that facility, there's probably going to be about 35 megawatts that's going to be utilized by the Fort Knox gold mine that's beginning construction this March in Fairbanks. It's be a very large open pit gold mine, and they are intending to use about 35 megawatts, and construction is beginning on the intertie between the existing electrical grid in Fairbanks to that mine. As regards the technology, this is a clean coal technology project, and there are a number of sort of very interesting aspects to the combustion technology that's going to be used in this project. There are, in essence, three things that power plant operators and environmental engineers are interested in, and what comes out of a power plant. In the vernacular, those are rocks, SOx, and NOx. Rocks are the ash that you want to keep from coming out the flue. NOx is nitrogen oxides, and SOx is sulfur dioxide. This technology has a combustor that you, in essence, bolt onto the side of a boiler that controls the chemistry in the initial combustion stage, so you don't create any nitrogen oxides. It will include a sort of limestone cleanup technology in the boiler and in capturing sulfur dioxide as calcium sulfate in the flue gas stream. And so those are the in terms of emissions, those kind of emissions, that's how the technology is addressing those pollutants. In terms of cleaning up ash, which is a concern of boiler operators everywhere, coal ash abrades the inside of the boiler, it corrodes tubes, it builds up and interferes with the heat transfer. This is a slagging combustor, and in essence it will take out the ash before it ever goes into the boiler as molten slag. Something like 90% of the ash will be removed before the combustion gases ever get in the boiler, which is as much a plus for maintenance and operating costs as environmental. A final thing that's very interesting about the technology is there are an awful lot of utility industrial boilers around the Pacific Rim that are getting towards the end of their useful lifetime, and one option is to rebuild them. And this may be one of the cheapest technologies where you can go and, in essence, modify an existing boiler, whether it's used coal or oil, modify it to use a coal product. And because it's a slagging combustor and because it enjoys and works best with coals that have ash that slag or at low temperatures, Alaskan coal, sub-bituminous coal, is a very good candidate for this kind of technology. So in the long run, with a successful demonstration of this technology, what we hope to see is that it will expand the market for Alaskan coals, especially sub-bituminous coals such as are found in Cook Inlet. So there's a lot of us up north that are very gratified this project is finally getting going. Right down from the residential electrical consumer to the coal supplier to other interests in coal around the state. And that's an unofficial observer's perspective of the Healy Clean Coal Project.
Charlie, thank you very much. On a short notice for a pitch hitter, you did pretty good. Appreciate that. Let the record reflect that Representative McLean came in at 10 after 5. And do we have any other questions for Charlie Green?
10 after 10, by the way. You mentioned 10 after 5.
What did I say?
10 after 5.
5 after 10. I beg your pardon.
I just had one question in regard to finance, which is my primary interest being on the Finance Committee. Is it true that we're looking at a shortfall in this project? I know that engineers' estimate came in at $25 million less than what the low bid was, if I heard you right. But in the course of trying to make up that gap, is there still a shortage that you're trying to...
I think the shortage remains in that it is still going through the process whereby DOE will forward fund the project. And if that comes through to the full extent, it's my understanding that, in essence, that $25 million gap has been bridged. It's also my understanding that if that doesn't happen, that ADA, within its organization, I don't know exactly what it is, a reserve, funds, has enough contingency to make up that gap. But I would defer being represented here as the official spokesman. If you have further questions on that, I'd be happy to contact Riley Snell, who's the director of ADA, and have him get back to you.
Thank you.
What's the amount of the gap? Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
It was $25
million. $5
million? Right. Of which, as I explained earlier, about $12 million has been made up through contributions by Golden Valley, Usabelli. Then there are other players in the project, including the equipment manufacturers that have made contributions, and I don't know the details on that.
Okay, thank you.
I may have one question for you. I was wondering if the rise in the global market price will have any effect at all on the profitability of this project, or is this domestic situation completely separated?
It's completely domestic, yes. Yes.
But the rise in price won't make any difference?
Not directly.
We hope to be a rise in price.
But if the technology becomes used, you know, in the Pacific Rim, and it provides export markets for expanding export markets for Alaska coal, then down the road, that's a very, very nice fortuitous thing to have, is rising demand, rising prices, and an expanding market for Alaska coal.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Charlie. We appreciate your talk. And next, we're going to call Warwick Wilson with the Alaska Coal Water Fuel.
Thank you.
Wilson, please.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Warwick Wilson, and I'm representing Alaska Coal Water Fuels, Incorporated. And I'm also here as a representative of the Energy and Environmental Research Center. I'd like to talk very briefly about the proposed low-rank coal water fuel demonstration project. And we've developed a brochure, just pass this down if you would, which I think will be most helpful in reviewing and giving you a sense of what this technology entails. The technology, we developed the technology at the Energy and Environmental Research Center. We were one of 5 Department of Energy Technology Centers until we were defederalized under the Reagan administration. Our location is in Grand Forks, North Dakota, which is the home of the University of North Dakota. Our mission while we were part of the Department of Energy was low-rank coal applications. So our mission was looking at ways to upgrade and help market low-rank coals nationwide. And as you've heard today, of course, the concerns or problems on marketing the low-rank coals have to do with the transportation issues, the high moisture, and things of this nature. So I think it's no surprise that we and everybody else looked at beneficiation techniques to improve the quality of the coal so it was more competitive on the international marketplace. The technology that we thought had, and still think, has the most potential is actually to beneficiate the coal, by having or causing a permanent moisture reduction. And this is done relatively simply by temperature and pressure. So we heat up a ground coal, a low rank coal. It reduces the equilibrium moisture and allows you to make a fuel that will support combustion on its own, a fuel with water. So in essence, we have low rank coal water fuel. The objective and the primary goal and the reason for the application of this technology is really twofold now. Number one, you now have a liquid that you handle from, our guess is that you will have the production plant right adjacent to the mine. So the mine coal will go in and be upgraded to coal water fuel. At that point, then you're transporting a liquid fuel and enjoying all the benefits. You've got pipeline transportation. You can use monoboy loading, and so you're not faced with the issues of deep water ports, per se. The end user receives it as a liquid, just as you would a heavy fuel oil, stores it in the existing facilities, and then combusts it as a liquid. It gets you out of the steam coal market and into the heavy oil market. As you'll note in the brochure, there's some information on the market potential on the far right-hand side. And the market for heavy oil is enormous. Today, just in the utility market alone, for Japan, Korea, and Taiwan, they're using over 200 million barrels of heavy oil, just in the utility market. And the industrial market is about that large, so it's an enormous market. That equates to about 80 million tons per year of coal water fuel. So we think there's a market potential. We've taken the technology at the EERC to the pilot scale, which is about a 6-ton per day plant. That has allowed us to make some economic projections as to the compatibility of this fuel, particularly in the Pacific Rim. And when you put all things together, taking a look at it from the global or North American perspective, there's really one prime area of opportunity, and that has to do with the Beluga coal fields. As you've heard earlier today, they're enormous, they're located near tidewater, and they're extremely low sulfur. So these are three very important points. In 1991, we put together a consortium to look at this technology and to look at actual applications using Beluga coal. We received funding from the U.S. Department of Energy and the Alaska Science and Technology Foundation to do pilot scale testing with a Beluga coal, and it was extremely successful. We produced a stable concentrated slurry, or coal water fuel, that had excellent combustion properties. And in fact, that led us to take the next step, or to propose the next step, which is a commercial scale demonstration. We have received a conditional commitment from the Alaska Science and Technology Foundation for a little over $3.9 million. They phased the approach and have awarded $180,000 for the first phase work, which was looking at defining the cost for the demonstration, obtaining a site for the demonstration, and doing some business planning as to how you would take this the next step to commercialization. The key so far is that we found an ideal location for the project, and that's the University of Alaska at Fairbanks. And we would plan to make use of the existing coal handling equipment at the university. They have both coal-fired and oil-fired boilers on campus. We would be looking at actually testing our low-rank coal water fuel in one of their existing oil-fired boilers. And there's a vacant building that actually has a coal lab in it adjacent to the power plant. So all in all, I think it's a very, very natural tie. There are additional synergisms with the operation at the university, which would we think will allow the project after the demonstration phase to continue as an actual operating plant there. I guess the two things to mention in addition to This demonstration would be about 150 tons per day. The objectives would be to develop real-world economics for the process. This would then enable potential end users to take our data, take it to their site, and put in their own body English on those economics to see if it makes sense. We want to demonstrate this fuel in an oil design boiler, and we'd like to demonstrate it in as many potential boilers as possible. So our objective will be to produce a lot of extra low-rank cold water fuel, and we're in the process now of getting end users, such as the TRW Combustion Group that have the Healy Clean Coal Project, the technology for that. But one thing I should mention that potentially has some real ramifications to the interior. What I've talked about before has all been driven by the international export market. We think the commercial size plant there that's going to make sense is something on the order minimum size, 1 million tons per year. But Cooper Energy Systems is developing a cold water fuel-fired diesel system, a stationary diesel. And we are negotiating with those people. They have a clean coal technology project that is jointly funded by the Department of Energy to demonstrate cold water fuels in that diesel engine. And the people at Cooper are very interested. They actually have a number of the diesels that are located in rural Alaska. They think their technology is something that, if demonstrated, would allow them to go in and change out, make a few modifications to the existing diesel engines. So it would be an opportunity to replace diesel with cold water fuel. And the key there is that cold water fuel is basically coal dispersed in water. It's non-hazardous and non-toxic. So the issue of the spills and leaks and cleanups is really not it's not a factor or problem with low or with cold water fuels, period. So we see some other opportunities, not only nations like Japan and Korea that are looking at reducing their dependency on imported oil, places like Hawaii, and we've made several trips to Hawaii with the Alaska Department of Energy just to talk to their officials over there. The state people are very concerned. There's a lot of heavy oil that's moved all around the islands. And one major problem over there could lead to a whole world of hurt. But anyhow, suffice it to say, those people are interested in the technology. If the economics hold up through the demonstration project, then I think the people in Hawaii are a very strong and good candidate for end users for the low-rank cold water fuel. So I think I've covered most of the key issues, and again, I think we tried to summarize everything as well as we could briefly in this brochure. Let me mention just one other thing and leave one other article. The World Coal, the most recent publication of this, actually talks about cold water fuel technology in general, focuses on the low-rank cold water fuel, and has an excellent write-up on the Alaskan demonstration project. So with that, I guess I would open it up to questions. I'll be happy to try and answer your questions. Representative Willis.
Mr. Chairman, you mentioned cold water fuel being a possibility for diesel generation. How about gas turbines?
Definitely so. And I just didn't mention it because I didn't see anything in the context of Alaska. But in fact, the most successful test we've had to date in an advanced engine, the EERC produced 20,000 gallons of low-rank cold water fuel that was used in General Motors Allison Division turbine simulator. And the fuel burned beautifully. The key is low-rank coal is better than high-rank coal in these advanced applications just because of its superior combustion. You know, we know it's low sulfur and we know the problems associated with it, but sometimes we tend to forget. The low-rank coals burn extremely well, rapidly. They don't have any tendency to agglomerate, so you get thorough and complete combustion. And in the tests at Allison, the worst that in terms of carbon combustion that was achieved with the low rank was 99.4%. The best they got with bituminous coal was around 96%. So that's a significant difference in wasting or not utilizing your fuel.
Thank you.
Any other questions. Representative McLean.
You mentioned that you had the first phase awarded by Science and Tech for $180,000.
That's correct.
So when is the next phase due?
We are completing phase one. Part of the contingency for the award of the remaining funding was successful completion of phase one, which one of the tasks that I mentioned was to find, develop a binding agreement with the end user and a site. And that we've accomplished with the University of Alaska at Fairbanks. The key, I believe, for the board of directors of ASTF's final approval will be the business plan. And I'm happy to say that Bob Stiles is on board, and DeArvin and his people at Bluger have become part of the project as well, and he will be leading our business plan development.
Mm-hmm. Now, how many phases do you expect to do to get to the $3.9 million?
We hope to have the proposal and everything completed to ASTF by their 13th of April meeting, where we would be asking for the balance of funding, the $3.8 million.
This year?
Yes. Now, we went initially to ASTF because this was by far the largest project they'd ever mm-hmm. sponsored, and raised the issue of large and small funding and so forth. Mm-hmm. I guess, to be very honest with you, that's another reason we're down here. We want to make you aware of the project and its potential, and also the possibility that ASTF or someone may need to come back and raise the issue of this small versus large project funding. ASTF believes they can move under existing Attorney General rules, I believe, on how they apportion out and grant the funding each year. So they believe that they can spread this over 3 or 4 years. The project itself is designed for 3 years from the time that we have all funding in place. I should mention that the funding was not earmarked, never was earmarked, to come out of the endowment. It's always been addressing the interest account. Mm-hmm. And it is totally contingent, and not a dime of the state money will be spent if we're unsuccessful in getting the $10.2 million from DOE. That's the other major part of the cost share. Consortium members, in terms of coal contributions, the site contributions, time, will be on the order of $8 million in initial. So we're looking somewhere between around $22 million is the total bottom line for this 3-year demonstration project. But there is certainly some likelihood and some concern on our part that ASTF funding could run afoul of the 50-50 rule.
Any follow-up? Do you want to go on? Okay. Can you tell me, on the lower end of this, how small is this practical area? What I'm wondering, is it practical for some of the smaller villages that are located where the coal is mm-hmm. as a fuel source?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Certainly in terms of competing in the world market, as I mentioned, we're thinking that somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million tons per year is the minimum size. But, you know, that's larger than you use in the whole interior and everywhere else. But when you look at some of the economic drivers in the interior, such as the problem with the cleanup eventual, or well, I guess the first step will be just the getting the rural bulk fuel storage capabilities up to minimum standards. You look at the cost of diesel in the interior. We think it does make sense, as small as maybe 40,000 tons per year for rural applications. And in that regard, we have been working with the folks at Doyon, and in fact did some pilot scale testing with Little Tanzana coal as a possibility. And if you could make that on one of the major river systems, that would allow you to barge transport it. We think there are some real opportunities there. Especially if the cold water fuel fired diesel proves out to meet everybody's expectations.
This is something we need to keep an eye on in the future.
Well, we appreciate it, and we certainly appreciate your interest. Thank you.
Okay, I think that's all. Thank you very much, Mr. Wilson. I appreciate your time. We have another 30 minutes. And we have 4 more people to speak, so if everybody just kind of time theirself to fit that, we'll all get out of here at 11. Next, we'd like to hear from Catherine Lammel. I hope that's right. Golden Valley Electric Association.
Close enough. I knew who you were talking to. My name's Kate Lammel.
Lammel, I'm sorry.
That's all right. With Golden Valley Electric Association, I'm the environmental officer, and I'm here today as a representative of the users of coal. And we have a 25-megawatt existing generation plant near the Healy Mine, right at Yucabelli. But recently, all of the coal users in the interior, there's seven power plants that use coal for generation. It's the predominant fuel of use in the interior for electricity. There's three military sites, Eielson, Clear, Fort Wainwright, Alaska Railroad, University of Alaska Fairbanks, Fairbanks Municipal Utility System, and Golden Valley that all have power plants for coal. We began a kind of a technical exchange group recently because some of the coal-fired power plants are having to watch the development of the new air quality regulations very closely to make sure that we will be able to operate in compliance during the development of it. In general, most of the plants do operate in compliance, but there were certain provisions in the regulations that are being rewritten now in response to the Clean Air Act Amendment of 1990 that were not giving us the operational flexibility that we needed, that being varying amounts of ash in the coal, varying amounts of sulfur in the coal. All of that, those percentages fluctuate minutely, but we sometimes have to comply on a almost second-by-second basis with the regulations. So we began this effort to watch the development of the regulations very carefully and to try to get our needs addressed in this development of the regulations. And in reality, there's exists right now about 100 air quality permits. With the new regulations out, that will probably go up to 400 permits. There's only seven coal-fired permits in the state, but that represents probably 75,000 people when you look at the network of people that it reaches. Some of the other issues that we're looking at.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I just missed the 75,000.
What we're looking at is the people that we serve
okay.
with the electricity.
Now, but you just said there were 100 air quality permits?
Existing right now.
Existing.
Seven are from four coal-fired power plants.
Okay. Thank you.
But I guess my point was that our interests are very far-reaching, or the impacts to what we do, because it affect the cost of electricity, what we have to do to comply.
Could I ask you a question, Mr. Chairman?
Sure.
I could. Mm-hmm. Ms. Lammel, does the Clean Air Act of 1990, within the state, does the state go over and beyond the Clean Air Act?
The regulations were signed in December. They mm-hmm. are now at EPA for approval. Mm-hmm. They're also currently being, there was a public comment period open for simultaneous review. There are certain aspects of the state regulations that appear to be more stringent than the federal regulations at this time. But they're not finalized yet, so in this last go-around, we're hoping to we can see what will happen with that.
So they are more stringent than
Some small specific areas, yes.
If you know of those specific areas, would you please provide the information to us? Thank you.
Yep. So the other issues, the air issue is a big one. We've just ended with a public comment period, so we have one issue in particular. It has to do with opacity. We've asked for some alternative limits on that based on what other states have done, other coal-burning states.
Mm-hmm.
The other things that we're working on in conjunction with Yucabelli and some of the other coal producers are the ways that coal is handled, the way that the fines are produced during the handling of the coal, trying to find better ways of handling the coal throughout the process from the mine to delivery to the various facilities. And then the other issue that we're watching very closely is coal ash. The power plants produce tons and tons and tons of ash on a daily basis. Ash is classified under the federal regulations as being an inert substance. We watch that the state regulations continue to carry that classification over being inert. Trying to juggle the various requirements of all of the various state agencies, DNR, state and federal, Corps of Engineers, in the way that we can handle and dispose of this inert, non-toxic, non-hazardous materials. We probably don't produce enough ash to make at this time to make a large marketable segment, but some parts of the country do market coal ash as a commodity. We probably don't produce enough of it to do that, but it's certainly something that we can watch. But bottom line is we want to make sure that the regulations allow us to dispose of it as a solid waste. And those are predominantly our issues, and if you have any questions.
Thank you. Representative McLean, do you have anything further?
She answered my question.
Squeezed them in there as we went along, and it worked out just right. I'm glad you did. I like that one question. I'm looking forward to the information on where we exceed the regulations.
We shouldn't.
That's what I think.
Clean Air Act is too stringent anyway to begin with.
It is going to have significant impact to rural. It's huge. The cost of complying with the air regulations is just very, very significant. Mm-hmm. And it's factored into our future budgets for the next several years to comply with those.
Okay, if there's no further questions for Ms. Lamal, we'll like to hear from Teresa M. with the Arctic Slope Consulting Group.
Thank you, Ms. Lamal.
Teresa?
My name is Teresa M., and I'm with the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, and I'm project manager of developing Western Arctic Coalfields. And unlike some of the other projects you've heard here today, we're strictly in a feasibility phase of developing this resource. And we are trying to develop lands, coal resource that's wholly owned by the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation in the Northwest Arctic. We're located approximately 90 miles due north of Red Dog, and I'll just show you on this map kind of where we are. I might be able to reach it, but this dark green semicircle right there on the coast, where the mine site that we've identified for development is approximately 10 miles off the Chukchi Sea. And the area is called Deadfall Syncline. It's a bituminous coal. Sorry, I've been listening about sub-bituminous coal. It's bituminous coal. It's a low moisture, low ash, ultra low sulfur coal with energy range in excess of 3,000 BTUs per pound. What we are in the process of is looking at the feasibility of developing a large scale underground coal mine. And so you've been talking about technology related to in-use and rural power development. We're trying to develop technologies here for developing a resource in the Arctic in which we have really no analogs for. There's underground coal development in Russia in permafrost regions, but because of mine health and safety and design parameters, we can't really use those as direct one-to-one correlation to what we're trying to do here. So we're involved with the U.S. Bureau of Mines in looking at developing a mine design in a permafrost region that will mine underground resources. We're also looking at the technology of transporting that coal out to export to the Pacific Rim. And what we've been involved in historically in the past with this project is looking at developing resource for a local Alaska domestic markets and then spinning off into the export market. We've re-looked at that. The economics are such that if we can develop the larger scale export market, we can back into the local domestic market in which we would be targeting the local villages along the west coast of the North Slope, Nome, Kotzebue, and then along western Alaska. We're at the point in the project where we've determined that we can underground mine the coal. Economically, it would be cost competitive with underground mines in the lower 48. We determined that we can mine relatively large quantities, not by lower 48 standards, but we're targeting a 3 million ton per year project. And we're in the process of trying to finalize our transportation. And we've got two alternatives that we're looking at. One is to go south to the Red Dog system and tie into the Red Dog port, utilizing that facility. Our second alternative that we're evaluating right now is developing a port right offshore of the mine site, in which we would try to extend our shipping season utilizing ice-breaking vessels. And so we have a few constraints that we're looking at related to that. One is shipping, is extending the shipping season such that we could ship that volume of coal out reliably through the Bering Straits. And then our second large issue that we're facing with marine transportation there is subsistence issues related to the people on the North Slope. So at that point right now, we're involved with the North Slope Borough in identifying training and trying to develop long-term training programs for training the local workforce up there to work in an underground mine. We're working extensively on reclamation and restoration guidelines for mine restoration in permafrost regions. We've got a lot of upfronts that we're kind of the first on, so we're looking, it's a broader sort of overview than some of the other projects that you've been listening to. So we've got, a lot of various fronts that we're moving forward on. It's a valuable resource. We've identified markets in the Pacific Rim. Our biggest challenge right now is resolving transportation for this project. And I'll keep it real short because I know we're running out of time. So if there are any questions.
Are there any questions, Representative?
Very well aware of the coal mining project.
I brought a brochure and a recent newsletter that I can leave here with you that kind of talks a little bit more in depth about some of our programs.
I think we have the brochure. I had two questions. When you say that you're cost competitive, you mean at the surface. You're not including transportation at all.
Not including transportation, but our mine costs are cost competitive with the lower 48 as, at the mine.
That's good news. And then when you talk about ice-breaking vessels, are there currently ice-breaking vessels operating that are capable of handling coal, or is this another thing that will have to be developed?
Well, it's a evolving technology, but the technology's there. And, for instance, the Russians move bulk material through ice regularly, and the Canadians as well move bulk materials through ice, as well as in the Baltic region, which is they have a smaller transportation. But what we're contracting to the Canadian CanArctic Shipping Company right now, they move bulk product out of two mines in northern Canada over an eight-month shipping season in more severe ice conditions, except for possibly the Bering Straits region, than what we're faced with in the Chukchi. And so it's a proven technology. We would have modified ships, that are being designed as part of this study, because what we need to do is optimize shipping both in an ice season and in an open water season. So we need to come up with an optimal design where we can utilize the ship for both. And then we have the kind of inland waters in north of the Aleutians, and we have the North Pacific. And so from a ship design parameters, there's a lot of different aspects you need to look at. And it may, in fact, you may be looking at two separate ship types and maybe a possible transshipping or location. And we're in the middle of evaluating all these various aspects right now.
One more thing. We heard earlier that the price of coal on the global market may be going up $2 to $6 mm-hmm. per ton in the near future or in the next year or so. Your coal being of a better quality, is it possible it would go up even more, or would it go up at the top of this range, or do you have any idea yet?
Our coal has been classified by some of the Japanese people we've been talking to as premium coal because of its ultra-low sulfur, it's 3% moisture, and it's a low ash coal. And so they're looking at it for blending purposes. And trying to optimize, basically there's more bang for the buck, so to speak, with this coal. So they're looking at it as a blending coal. I think there's a lot of talk right now about sulfur dioxide emissions. Certainly the Pacific Rim's getting on their emission control. There's talk of possible penalties for high sulfur coal being imported into some of these Pacific Rim countries, in which case we wouldn't see that. None of the Alaska coal would see that. But we also have the low ash, because ash handling is a big issue in some of these countries where they have small areas for disposal and are actually exporting some of their ash disposal. So from the quality points, we may in fact see some higher end of that, but that's still to be proven on the market.
Yeah, we hope so. Okay, I don't guess we have any further questions, Teresa. Thank you very much. I appreciate you coming and talking to us. And, yes, I'm sorry.
You know what, Representative James should be here, because she's always into railroads. And I keep telling her, if she were to endorse a railroad from Point Lay to Wainwright to Prudhoe Bay, she would get all the natural resources all in one row and into Fairbanks.
We'll try to furnish her with a transcript of this.
Thank you very much.
While I have you here, I want to introduce, with the Arctic Slope Consulting Group, we have Governor Bill Sheffield here, and I apologize for not introducing you earlier. You didn't sign in, and I just forgot it. I apologize, Governor. Thank you for coming. Appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I'd like it to go on the record, too, that the members should be here when we're having finance subcommittee meetings, because it's very crucial, since we're the only two here.
Thank you. I appreciate that. There have been different ones here early and late. I think everyone's been here at some point. But they're in and out. They've got, yes. Some of them have bills up and things like that. They've all had a good excuse.
We should write a memo to that effect.
Okay. Next, we'd like to hear from Mr. John Sims with Usabelli.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Sims, Vice President of Marketing for Usabelli Coal Mine. The two issues I want to briefly touch on are federal in nature. One goes back a long, long way, and it's the infamous Jones Act, which has its origins 70 years ago. It's legislation which certainly impedes Alaska's ability to trade with other U.S. states, and particularly Hawaii and the Pacific Northwest and California, in terms of the coal trade. Several years ago, Senator McCain